From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Monday, April the 13th, 2020, and we have a good full show for you this morning. Elizabeth Hewitt of VTDigger.org is going to be my first guest. We'll bring her on in just a minute or so after I tell you about what else is coming on the program this morning. Elizabeth will be talking to us about recent stories in VTDigger.org, as well as one she did about a very tough issue in this time of social distancing, the coronavirus and all, and that is the issue of what happens in split families when there's shared custody of children, and how does that handoff work when we're all supposed to be staying home and not traveling and staying 6 feet apart and all the rest of it. It is a tough set of issues for some families there. We'll be talking with Senator Joe Benning in the second half hour of the program this morning. He comes on between about 9:35 and 10. We are going to get his take on recent developments in the legislature, as well as how he thinks state government has been responding to the COVID-19 crisis and its efforts. We'll be hearing from Senator Benning then. Later on in the program, my guest will be Kaya Morris. She is a former state representative from Bennington, who, of course, you probably recall, resigned from the legislature a couple of years ago after some serious harassment based on a lot of racial issues. She's African-American. She now has taken a job with a group called Rights and Democracy. It's a progressive activist group in Vermont, and we're going to be checking in with Kaya Morris about her new role in Vermont's public life, so that should be an interesting conversation as well. Let's start off, though, with our friend Elizabeth Hewitt from VTDigger.org. Good morning, Elizabeth. Thanks so much for joining me.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I hope you are as well.
A little soggy.
Yeah, a lot of work this weekend. Big report in VT Digger this morning. The VTDigger.org, of course, excellent online news site. And you are a key player there, keeping things moving over the weekends, I think, a lot lately. And so that's great. Wanted to check in with you first about sort of the general stories of VT Digger, and then we'll focus in on a story you did, which is very interesting. But the top story on the site this morning.
In order for us to be able to respond
concerns
quickly,
Copley Hospital. What's going on there?
Oh, so they Copley Hospital has rolled out a new type of test that can test folks for COVID-19 antibodies, and this it's a new test that's just being released and starting to be used in different parts of the country. There's only a few hospitals. It's a relatively small number of hospitals that are doing it. Copley is the only one in Vermont that's doing it. And basically, this blood test might be able to determine who is immune and who might be able to return to work without fear of being infected or passing the virus along. So this is pretty new and pretty enticing technology. There's a lot of hope that this could really help kickstart the economy because there'll be a sense of who can be safely back in public places. And Copley, just to begin with, they're offering it for healthcare workers at the hospital. It's a blood test. It returns its results within 10 minutes. It's a really quick turnaround. They're using it with their staff members to see who might be carrying the virus, see whether people have developed these antibodies.
That's really interesting. Obviously, I'm sure a lot of people around the country would be really eager to be tested and to be shown perhaps to have already experienced this illness and maybe not have known it at the time. But now to be able to say, hey, I've had this thing, I'm over it, I'm immune or whatever. I mean, is that the goal here? Are people basically going to be able to take a test and say, I've cleared those hurdles, I've had COVID-19, I'm now immune, and I'm basically, you know, kind of not only not going to be a vector, I'm not going to infect anybody else with COVID-19, but I also I've got a green light here, basically.
So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of questions still. This is still a very new virus, and there's a lot that still needs to be answered about this. But there's some optimism that this this coronavirus might behave in the way that others do, where people develop immunity to it after they get it. You know, there's questions about if different strains will be able to hit people, or sort of how that will proceed. Dr. Anthony Fauci, from who's sort of leading the federal response to this, he has said that he believes that if somebody is infected, like in February or March, and then they recover, that like this fall, that person is likely to be protected from the virus. So there's some sort of optimism that if you have it, that you might not get it again. This particular test is like I said, quite new. It's just rolling out in different places, and mm-hmm. it hasn't gone through like the full FDA approval that things typically do. That said, the FDA has not blocked this from going forward. And the folks that our healthcare reporter Katie Dickling spoke to were, you know, pretty optimistic, and they sort of said there's no lose situation here. Like you know, we don't know exactly how well this works. We don't really. There still are questions about it, but that, you know, whether it's great, whether it's a flop, you know, they can try it out, and that there's opportunity for it to be an upside here.
How did Copley end up actually being here?
You know, I'm not sure exactly how they ended up with it. Their CEO is really optimistic about it. I'm not sure exactly how they ended up.
Okay. And I guess among the other questions I have is, are people basically beating down their doors now? Hey, test me.
So these are, they're offering it for their, for their staff workers at the moment. So mm-hmm. They've tested 40 staff members. One of those people tested positive. Six others had uncertain results. And then after those test results came back, all of those people were then referred to get the nasal swab test. That is the one that is being used more commonly to diagnose it, to see if those folks are currently carrying the coronavirus.
I see. And in terms of the test for having the antibodies, is that a blood test, or how does that actually get performed?
It's a blood test. It's a sort of described as a small pinprick, and then it's on a test strip, and then it just the results come back as a colored stripe. It's red for positive, pink for inconclusive, and white for negative. They're also interesting. They're cheaper than the tests that are being used the ones that are being used for diagnostic purposes more broadly. These cost about $14 a piece, and then those other swabs that are being used more widely, those are about $50. Although folks, those are not there's no charge for those.
Yeah, and I'm curious. I mean, I wonder whether, in terms of if you're a healthcare administrator, and you are trying to, you know, figure out your budget and so on. Obviously, in one instance, $14, $50, you know, may not seem like a life changing event. But if you add up a couple thousand of these tests that you might administer over a period of a month or something, it would be a consideration, I'm sure. And I'm wondering, will there ever get to be a protocol where someone who someone might come in and be tested first for the antibodies, and then if they don't have the antibodies, then they might be tested for the presence of the virus?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot still up in the air with the protocols. Mm-hmm. The whole thing is so new. I mean, you think about the length of time that it typically takes things to move through the full testing procedure. I think there's a lot of questions that remain, but you know, there is a lot of optimism that this could be, you know, this additional technology is sort of another tool that we have now to be combating this. And similar technology has been used in China and South Korea. I think that that they've been used there to sort of help in the response. So. It seems like it's a moment of some optimism with this new technology, and yeah, it's pretty cool that it's happening here in Vermont.
Yeah, that is cool, and I wish Copley good luck with their participation in this. I think that's it's got to be kind of an exciting honor for them, just to be one of the hospitals that's able to offer this, even if to their own staff right now. I mean, I gather that's I'm sure they'll be seeing that as a first step, preliminary kind of thing, and the. It looks like another VT Digger story here that I wanted to ask you about. You know, one of the real tough questions for state government, especially as we move through this, has been when you find populations of people who are have specific challenges in sort of the regular course of life, and you have to take special steps to try to protect them against the COVID-19 virus. You know, that sets up a whole different range of challenges than I think most Vermonters are dealing with right now, just in terms of the requirement that they stay home, and a lot of folks aren't working, and all the rest of the stuff with which everybody is familiar. Here's a headline of VT Digger this morning. It says, South Burlington Holiday Inn will be COVID-19 recovery site for homeless population. And I was just wondering, this story essentially shows us that, I mean, there's a population, as I said a moment ago, faces a lot of challenges in the normal course of events, and now this COVID-19 comes along. What's the plan there?
Right. So this is part of the response that we're seeing in Burlington, as the city is sort of preparing to try to take care of folks who are homeless, to sort of prevent the virus from spreading widely through different communities. And this latest move with the Holiday Inn, this comes after the city has already been working with a new place, is a nonprofit in Burlington, and they that runs shelters. And of course, shelter is not a great place in terms of trying to reduce contact between people. You know, the advice, the prominent public health advice right now is to be sort of trying to minimize contact with others, and so communal spaces are really tough. And so the response that they've come up with is that they have a series of campers set up at North Beach in Burlington, and mm-hmm. that's to sort of allow people, you know, places to be sheltered and safe, while also being not in those communal spaces. So the Holiday Inn, this latest development there is that they are, the Holiday Inn is going to serve as a place where if people who are homeless have, if they contract the virus and are affected with it, but they're not at the level of illness that they require hospitalization, that the Holiday Inn will be a place where they can go and, you know, be safe and recover. And yeah.
Okay, so this would be a homeless person who has a positive test who would be sent to the Holiday Inn, basically?
Yeah, that's my understanding, yep.
Yeah, okay, huh. That's that is interesting. interesting story by Kevin O'Connor here. Vermont Easter celebrations move online amid coronavirus crisis. And, of course, opposite picture was featured heavily in the news over the weekend, where some churches around the country went ahead and held services. And I saw a picture of one that looked like they were trying to maintain some kind of social distancing, where people were fairly spread far apart in the pews in the church that was photographed in one online report I saw. Anybody in Vermont actually hold a church service this past weekend, you know?
You know, I'm not sure about that. Kevin has been following a bunch of different ways that life is moving online, and he had been, I know he has been interested in seeing how religious communities have been adjusting their schedules given the coronavirus pandemic. And so he really was focusing on sort of the ways that that Vermont church communities were preparing to be celebrating with online live stream services. And you know, it's interesting. I think there were some really interesting insights from different folks around the state about how about how sort of the symbolic that this is a bit of a symbolic not being able to go to church was really symbolically significant to a lot of them right now as well. There was meaning, even though folks weren't able to come together for Easter, that there was real meaning for them in the way that they were able to celebrate.
Yeah, that is interesting, and I sort of and by the way, I will say, you know, I want to express my sympathy also toward these folks. You know, a lot of people are very, very devout and serious about their faith and going to a church or a synagogue or other religious facility and gathering together as a community are such important traditional parts of faith that to miss them is a really pretty heavy duty thing, and I don't mean to, and I won't make light of it because it's very important to people, and I want to acknowledge that and express that, you know, I feel for you. I think it's a tough situation. Bishop Christopher Coyne, the head of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Vermont, on a week or two ago about just the upcoming Holy Week and how all that was going to work out. The diocese was taking all of this very seriously and essentially had shut down actual, you know, gatherings. And again, that's just got to be, you know, lots of Catholic friends and loved ones and so on who, I think it's throwing a lot of people for a loop, and I think that's a very tough circumstance, and I just hope and think that they got to get through this somehow. So I hope that works out.
I think, you know, this is a really significant time in a lot of different faiths. That we also had a story last week about how Jews in Vermont mark Passover. The ways that they sort of use digital tools to come together. Later this month, in Islam, the month of Ramadan will begin on April 23rd. So it's interesting to see, you know, I think one of the things that I'm finding really interesting as a journalist covering this is how people are finding ways to continue really important parts of life without being able to safely go to the places that we typically go, I maybe I'll do a little call out here that at Dicker, you know, we really like hearing from folks about how they are adjusting their lives. You know, if you're doing, as you're celebrating these different things or just moving through life, let us know, because this is a really unusual time, and I think a lot of the stories of how people are coming together are really beautiful.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I think will be a story sometime in the, I hope not distant future, is that, you know, I suspect reporters will be looking to find out whether, I mean, let's, you know, another big development or trend in kind of American religiosity, and certainly that here in Vermont, has been declining attendance at worship services of all kinds. And I sort of wonder whether this phenomenon of all of a sudden really emphasizing the online availability of this kind of thing will maybe bring some people back. You know, and I'm thinking it's tough to get up on Sunday morning, I'm sure, for some people, you know, and go to church. And so that's sort of like I don't want to get dressed up and go to church, you know. and so there you go. There's a contributing factor in declining attendance, and so if all of a sudden you can basically go to church online, maybe that'll enhance participation down the road. I don't know, but could be interesting development there. Hey, Elizabeth, before I let you go, I did want to give some time to your story about this other, you know, so many things that we're trying to figure out how to adapt and how to adjust to this weird world we suddenly find ourselves living in. And one subset of the population being very heavily affected here are families, particularly those which have, you know, gone through a divorce or whatever. There have been shared custody arrangements. The kids go to one house for X days or a week or whatever, and the other house for an alternating time period. And all of a sudden that becomes very difficult. What's going on that front?
Sure. Yeah. So I think a lot of parents, when the governor's order, his stay home order came out last month, I think it was a pretty jarring instruction. And, you know, parents are concerned about the safety of their children and their families. And one parent that I spoke with sort of was like, you know, if the governor is telling us to stay home, does that mean that if I'm, you know, driving my kid to drop them off, does that mean that I'm going to get pulled over and asked, you know, what I'm doing out? That is not the case. You know, the courts have been very clear, and the administration, the Scott administration, has been clear as well that they, you know, exchanging children between parents as part of a custody agreement is. That remains in place. That is considered essential during this time. But, you know, there's still, despite that, there are a lot of complications that come up for people. I mean, one thing is that schedules have been disrupted. So just on a practical matter, you know, kids aren't going to school, so it's not as easy to drop your kid off in the morning and then have them go to the other parent right after school. And then there's like a lot of, it sort of has raised, put new significance on different elements of this, right? So like if one parent might have an underlying health condition that makes them more vulnerable to the illness, what does that mean for having a regular exchange? Like if you have if the child is going back and forth, could they potentially become a carrier? And how do you adjust in that? I spoke with a lot of family law attorneys across the state who said that they've been getting a lot of questions from parents about what to do and what's safest for their families and if they want to change things, how they're supposed to go about that. There are opportunities. You know, the courts are have largely shut down their regular activities because during the state of emergency, but they are considering certain emergency motions. So like if a family situation rises to the level that that they, you know, that it counts as an emergency, then they could petition the court and potentially get a new order, get their order amended. So there are legal opportunities to change it, but you know, for a lot of parents, one attorney that I spoke with, she said that, you know, a lot of parents are sort of figuring out together, they're working together to figure out what the safest and best arrangement and changes that they can make without going to the courts. But it's a really complex issue and one that's really emotional, right? Because, you want to, when things are scary, you want to be with your child and you want to be making safe decisions.
Yeah, the parent you interviewed from, I believe, Hinesburg, it was, you actually quote in here as there was a quote about when the world is on fire, you want to be with your kid. I believe it was that's when the world is on fire, you want to be with your kid. And you know, these circumstances of child custody sharing and so on are tough and emotional and as you know, can be difficult even in the best of times. I think we all know. And if you layer this over that, you know, basic situation there, it just becomes that much harder, I think, for a lot of folks. And one of the other quotes I was really struck by in the story, just in terms of the, you know, this sort of whiplash feeling people are getting out there. You interviewed Patricia Benelli, a lawyer in Chester, chair of the family law section of the Vermont Bar, said, they have one order from the courts and another from the governor, and they're conflicting. So I can see why a lot of families would be in the sort of what do we do now kind of a frame of mind here. Meanwhile, there's all this issue of kids being home from school, which means more time with whichever parent. And so, wow, what a tough set of problems here.
Right. Yeah. It's complex and it's, lawyers are sort of hoping to get some more guidance from the courts so they can better advise their clients on how they should be proceeding. I reached out to the chief superior judge on this, and he doesn't expect that the courts are going to be issuing any more guidance because, as he put it, all of these situations are so unique and they're so particular and tailored to the individual families. And so it's hard to really create like a blanket situation here. You know, as such, it just means that there's so many people that are in just such particular situations. I would just add that, you know, again, the courts and attorneys are saying that right now if you have a custody order that determines, you know, contact with between children and families, children and parents on a certain schedule, those are still in force regardless of the stay home order, and that's sort of what courts are expecting people to follow, but that for folks that need that feel that they should change, that their situation should change, that attorneys that I spoke with said, you know, try to reach out to an attorney and talk about your options.
Tough situation all around, as there are so many of them in this time. Elizabeth Hewitt of VTDigger.org, thank you so much for being my guest this morning on the Dave Graham Show. It's always good talking with you.
It's a pleasure to chat, Dave.
Alrighty, we're going to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News, a couple words from our sponsors, and we'll be back with Senator Joe Benning in the second half hour of the program. Stay with us, folks.
There's comfort in the familiar, but when life presents us with something exciting, we just have to embrace it. With so many of our neighbors producing such wonderful products, we just have to show and tell the world. Come in and see for yourself the old standbys alongside the new. Change is good. The one thing that never changes is our commitment to making your visit a great experience. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Thanks for staying with us into our second half hour of this Monday morning, April the 13th, 2020. And we like to check in occasionally with some of our legislative leaders. We've had Tim Ash, the president pro tem of the Vermont Senate, on recently. We've had Dave Zuckerman, the lieutenant governor, on. Dave may be coming back on the program sometime this week. I'm trying to reach out to him and arrange that. And then the we wanted to get the a GOP voice on the air here as well. You like to mix it up here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. Joe Benning is the minority leader in the Vermont Senate, and he's been in on all of the meetings and all of the efforts to make legislating remotely possible, shall we say. And Joe Benning joins me on the phone this morning. And good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me, and I hope you and yours are all healthy and socially distant and all of that good stuff, because obviously we all want to avoid this illness if we can possibly do that. So,
like everybody else, we're hunkering down.
Hunkering down, yes, indeed. And first off, I mean, let's talk about that for just a minute. That's got to be a strange feeling, because I mean, I know you were out on your motorcycle. You're a big motorcycle guy, really love to get out and do those trips. A week or two ago, I saw on Facebook, took a trip, and I guess you got some grief for that. You also were talking to me about your own efforts to really, you know, maintain safety and social distancing and all that good stuff while you were out recreating. Talk to me about the sense of, here it is, springtime in Vermont, the first warm days coming around. A lot of people, I'm sure, who are motorcycle enthusiasts or enthusiasts for anything outdoors usually is done in warmer weather, wanting to get out there and do it. There's just a feeling of, wait a minute, what are we doing here kind of thing, isn't there?
Well, I think it's important to note first that my normal motorcycling activity is done with a group of friends. We have lunch together. We stop for an ice cream later in the day. It's a social event. None of that took place on this particular occasion. I was wrapped in a helmet and gloves, and I was about as much of a human cocoon as you can possibly imagine.
Yeah,
The point of it is, we can't avoid doing things that we love, but we definitely have to modify how we do them in dealing with this particular crisis. I don't want to suddenly suggest that everybody should go out there and do things they love to do as they normally would. I envision if, you know, you're normally in a canoe situation where you like to go with two people at least in a canoe. You might switch to a kayak instead and isolate yourself, but we have all got to stay healthy. We have all got to stay physically fit. So if you're out hiking, you practice social distancing. And you also have to stay mentally healthy to be able to confront what we're all facing right now. And that was my particular way of exercising some mental health. We literally like to call it dual wheel therapy.
Yeah, I get you. I mean, I think that is very important. And people, if you can figure out a way not to deprive yourselves out there, don't deprive yourself, because as you put it, that is very important to your mental health, and just feeling like we're all going to get through this. And you know, people have sort of I don't know, work and then rewards in their lives, and you gotta feel like there's some reward still in the mix. So you know, I should add in though
that as I was riding around Vermont, and by the way, I stayed in Vermont, but there were people that were out on bicycles, socially isolated. The most humorous part of it for me was seeing a group of family members on one side of the road in their lawn chairs talking to another group from a family on the other side of the road in their lawn chairs, and me riding in between them. And all of us started waving and smiling, and you got the great sense of we're all in this together and we're all acting appropriately.
Yeah, yeah. It is kind of funny how people are adjusting. We had a Zoom meeting. I'll fess up. A Zoom cocktail hour with some neighbors a couple of Sundays ago, and it was okay. I mean, you know, it was sort of like, okay, here's what we're gonna do to get together. But then a few days later, I was on my porch and I saw across our backyard in the driveway next door, our next door neighbor who just happened to be, I don't know, coming out of her house or heading into her house or something. And it was just, there she was in the flesh and blood. And I said, boy, that really, just seeing her in, you know, in person instead of on a screen just makes a big difference.
We have a local group of high school girls that get in their cars. They drive to the local mall parking lot, which is totally empty. And of course they all miss each other. So they put their cars in such a position, kind of like the old circling the wagons routine. And they talk to each other from their cars in the parking lot. And that's the kind of stuff you have to do in order to keep spirits up and people properly isolated from each other. But I applaud them for being able to do that and convince others that the world is going to be okay at the end of the day.
Yeah, I tell you, speaking of cars, among the people I feel for, people don't have cars or are used to using public transit or whatever, because obviously that world has taken some adjustments as well. Let's talk about the legislature for a moment, because that's one of the reasons I wanted to get you on the air here and to get your take on the situation in the Vermont Senate in particular. You, if I understand this correctly, you all did have actual remote floor action this past week, right?
Well, we did have floor action, and we test drove the remote voting first. And let me back up to say that there were a lot of people that were giving us grief because they thought we were too stupid to know how to use Skype and whatnot. The problem was that we are required by the Constitution and our own laws to meet and gather collectively. And if you are not present in a committee room or on the Senate floor, until last week, you had no power to vote. So people didn't understand that in order for us to get a remote voting situation into place, we literally had to have a quorum meet on the Senate floor and vote to have that happen. And that was pretty awkward under the current declaration of emergency and the stay-at-home instructions. So we actually had a committee of three. It was myself, Becca Ballant, and John Bloomer, who drafted a new rule to enable this to happen. And this new rule has never been in our system before. The only time the legislature has failed to meet in the state office, the state house, back in 1857, when the state house burned, the governor called people into session anyway, and they met at a local church and I believe the courthouse. So there has been a situation of remote voting, but certainly not electronically. And so we had to design a complete new set of rules in order to enable that to happen. And then we had to go through the motions of physically gathering in order to pass that rule. So we have a new rule in place. We started last week with a test drive. And then after the test drive seemed to work, we called the legislature back into session. 16 of us showed up to be a quorum in the Senate. And then the Senate voted to change its rule. And then the following day, I think it was the following day, it's all seeming to blend together these days lately, but we subsequently did an electronic session and voted to have this rule be brought into place. And, of course, we passed several pieces of legislation that were directly COVID-19 related.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite an interesting week.
Yeah, I bet. And I'm just wondering, are you comfortable with to the extent that the rule passed by the Senate sort of passes constitutional muster? Because historically, I had thought previously up until this time, the Constitution would create pretty much an absolute bar to people voting on legislation who were not in that room.
Well, the actual language of the Constitution is that the General Assembly's doors shall remain open to the public, unless mm-hmm. there's some situation that prevents that from happening by way of a threat inside the facility. So we designed a rule that has as much transparency as you could possibly get under the circumstances. All committees, at least on the Senate side, all committees are required to conduct their business with video and audio capabilities and allow the public to have access to that. The Senate floor is the same way. We have to have audio and visual capabilities, and the public has to have access to that, so that literally all the business that normally is conducted inside the building is repeated, even though we are meeting remotely around the state. All of our business is in the public eye, and that's the most important critical element in answering your question. I believe the constitutional issues are taken care of when you enable the public to have the same access, only in a completely different and nobody ever thought about before method. But I think we are passing constitutional muster.
Well, this is interesting. Do you feel like right now, given the electronic operations or remote operations of the legislature, that it might be more transparent than usual? Because I know during the typical legislative session, there are many moments when, you know, lawmakers kind of step around a corner somewhere in the building and look over their shoulders and make sure none of us pesky reporters are listening and have a key conversation. Or there are other times when people disappear into that Senate cloakroom and close the doors and work out some deal on legislation or whatever. Less of that going on now?
Dave, are you insinuating that we somehow don't like you guys in the press?
I wouldn't.
I will have to agree with you that I personally feel this is more transparent than it has ever been before. And one of the other elements of the rule that's in place is that every vote we take is done by roll call. I have a feeling that issue is going to change because of the length of time it took us to go through four bills remotely was probably twice or three times as long as we normally would have done business. But right now, the rule was designed specifically to not only allow public access, but to demand on each and every occasion that every senator's vote was recorded with their face and their voice freely exposed to the public in a YouTube presentation.
Huh. Wow. It's interesting times, I got to say. I believe we do have a caller on the line, a listener calling in, Thomas from Montpelier. Good morning.
Good morning, David, Mr. Benning. I am concerned about the lack of public access and the actual non-transparency of what has been going on in the Senate. And for example, you were talking earlier about the Senate having actually conducted business on Friday. Well, reading the journal as to what happened on Friday. One of the bills they took up was S-114, and it had to do with expungement of misdemeanor marijuana possession convictions. And then on the floor in second reading, they stripped out everything about medical marijuana and put in sections on rent escrow and real estate and some other things. So someone who is trying to follow the bills by title don't really know what's going on. And this isn't the only bill that's happened. It's happened on three or four other bills at the session that they actually held in the State House on March 24th, was it? And it has become really difficult to follow what's going on. And then instead of following the normal procedure of putting it on the notice calendar for third reading at another session, the Senate suspended all the rules on this bill and previous bills and rushed it through all of the other stages of passage, third reading, the notice and then third reading. And they suspended the rules and they passed it all later that session. So I'm not sure that there is really transparency when all of these things are being rushed through without giving the public a chance to figure out what's going on.
Let's let Senator Benning respond here. What do you make of all this, Senator?
Well, Thomas, first off, thank you very much for the question. You are correct that S-114 was changed dramatically. And to people who are following that particular bill or were following that particular bill might be very upset that all of a sudden the language that it had was literally hijacked in order to put in a COVID-19 related issue that was a lot different than what the underlying bill had originally been there for. My answer is going to be a bit of procedure in the process. We have had instructions from the leadership that our activities for the immediate future will be totally COVID-19 related. The moratorium on rents and evictions was an issue that came up and was in need of immediate attention. In order to get that in front of the body, we had to pick a bill that was already on the calendar, literally strip it of all of its language, and use that number, S-114, as a vehicle to attach the COVID-19 related issue to. So that was the bill that was chosen. If people were upset about that particular language being removed, I can certainly understand that. But the intent is to have that language come back in a different bill when we have non-COVID related issues that we can deal with at a time when we're not in the emergency we are in. So it's a fair point to say that there was some lack of transparency there. But given the circumstances of the emergency, we were acting very quickly to try to react to an emergency problem. And unfortunately, for those who were in favor of that bill or watching it carefully, that happened to be the vehicle we had to use. But we couldn't literally start from scratch with a new bill and ram it through the system. We had to have something that was already on the calendar to make that happen. And that's why procedurally, that particular bill got stripped of its content and the number associated with it became the new vehicle to move forward with. And I'll conclude this part of my answer by saying leadership has maintained throughout since March 13th that no issues being dealt with in the legislature that are not COVID-19 related or directly associated with our adjournment, meaning the money bills, will be taken up for discussion at this point in time because we all believe we are still in the state of emergency and we need to continue dealing with COVID-19 related issues.
That's That is, I can hear both sides of this debate. I think you're both making really valid points here, Thomas. I understand your concern about transparency, and especially, you know, the substance of this bill is obviously important to a lot of people. The idea of expunging misdemeanor convictions for marijuana is something that has been worked on for a while. I gather basically it's kind of a senator. Is it fair to say a wait till next year situation on that one at this point?
Well, we don't know. I mean, when is the declaration of emergency going to drop? That's the first question.
Okay.
And none of us really know the answer to that. And if the situation continues to the point where we literally have to adjourn, then the answer to your question would be yes, it's going to happen until next year. I want to say, Dave, I don't want to make this a debate between Thomas and I. The fact is he's raised a legitimate issue. And as I look back in hindsight, I think the reporter of the bill or the leadership should have stood on the floor and said, this is why we're taking X number bill and hijacking it to deal with this particularly concerning emergency issue. So I think he raises a very fair point. And in hindsight, I think I'll work to see if we can't make sure that is taken care of for transparency purposes, because he is correct. And I don't want to create an idea that we're somehow in disagreement with each other.
Very interesting. Hey, one last question for you, Senator, just with a minute or two to go here. What do you think about the transfer of inmates from the Northwest State Correctional Facility in St. Albans Town over to St. John? Those found to have tested positive over to the facility in St. Johnsbury. I gather, you know, that's right in your district, and I gather you might have some thoughts about that.
Well, I have a lot of thoughts about that, and I would encourage anybody who wants to hear about it in the detail that I dealt with it over the past 2 days, and literally all day Easter Sunday. There has been a great deal of frustration. There were communication breakdowns, and we needed to set straight what happened, why it happened, and how to correct it in the future. So I would encourage people that are interested in the answer to that question to climb onto my Facebook page, and you'll see the details.
Senator, we're about out of time, I'm afraid, but I really appreciate you joining me this morning. Let's talk again soon. Thank you. Joe Benning of Caledonia County, folks. Back after some CBS News.
Lawson's Finest, classic clothing in cutting-edge fashion. Our huge sandwiches and grab-and-go meals, toys, a wide selection of rosé, jewelry, accessories, quarter-pound cookies, and even more beer. Yankee Magazine doesn't call us the best one-stop shopping in Vermont for nothing. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And I want to open the phone line for a few minutes. We have an open period now until about 10:15, and 244-1777 is the local number, 1-877-291-8255. If you're calling from a little bit more distance and want to do so toll-free, you are welcome to use that telephone. One interesting news development over the weekend was a retweet yesterday from the President Donald Trump of a tweet that a former, I guess, Republican congressional candidate said, where he had the hashtag Fire Fauci, Fire Anthony Fauci, the director of infectious disease and for the federal government, who has been a main player in the COVID-19 response of the Trump administration, appearing pretty much daily with the president on those briefings at the White House on the government's response to COVID-19. Dr. Fauci yesterday was on one of the, I believe it was on CNN, and got some questions from Jake Tapper about the response of the administration to date. And Tapper was going back through that period in January and February when a lot of people have questioned whether the Trump administration should have acted more quickly to try to get ahead of the COVID-19 outbreak and the ensuing crisis and so on. And Dr. Fauci made some pretty mild comments about just, you know, obviously looking at it in retrospect, you would think that it might have been better to get out ahead of a unfolding crisis sooner, but we are where we are, and that drew the ire of some conservative commentators, as in they took it as a slight on the president and his leadership. And so President Trump yesterday said, retweeted this thing that had the hashtag Fire Fauci. And I know that in other cases that when you see something like that from the president, that can oftentimes mean that the person who comes into the crosshairs there is a short timer in the Trump administration. So we'll see what unfolds for Dr. Fauci. But I believe we do have a caller on the line. It's Rama from Williamstown. Good morning, Rama.
Good morning. First off, I want to say kudos to many of the nation's governors, not all of them. I think many of the nation's governors, I think many of the nation's people have taken this issue seriously and been willing to take the necessary stops to keep what could have been a huge, huge, huge disaster down to just being a huge disaster. So I want to start with that. The other point is, and it really is what you were just talking about with Trump and Fauci. Kudos to Mr. Fauci, too, Dr. Fauci. I mean, he's been done a yeoman's work job of trying to walk that delicate balance between stroking Trump's ego, to put it in a polite manner, while he somehow manages to get out honest, real information to the American public on a national platform. So kudos to him. And all I can say is really just is shame on the entire Republican Party. I don't care if they're the Vermont Republican Party. I don't care if they're the Republican. This is just, you can't avoid complicity in this. Despite what we see happening in the White House and the type of individual there is an entire national political apparatus that supports this guy, and everybody who is just not blindly Republican ought to be thoroughly scared by this prospect. That's all.
Well, Rob, I'm going to give you a little bit of pushback there, because I don't think we can put all Republicans in the same bucket. And I have in mind, first on my list, Governor Phil Scott, who has been responding to this thing in a much different way from the president. He has really kept electoral politics out of his own very frequent briefings. By the way, I should mention he's going to be doing another one a little after 11 today, and we're going to broadcast it live on WDEV. Programming note for you folks, don't touch that dial when the Dave Graham Show goes off at 11, because Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials are scheduled to hold a news conference this morning at just after 11. So stay with us for that. But Rama, you know, there are some Republicans out there around the country still who are would probably be more deserving of praise from you than you want to send toward this president.
Well, first of all, as individual people go, and I agree, I think Scott's done a wonderful job of this, but I no matter how good of a job he does, as long as he keeps aligning himself politically with what's in our Oval Office right now at the national level, I'd never vote for him. I don't care. I don't care if he came and dropped $1 billion in unmarked 100s off at my front door. He would not get my vote.
And wow.
This is it. Listen, you know, we've had the same general type of discussion regarding the Catholic Church and the child abuse and child rape, et cetera, there.
Yeah.
You give the same argument. I'll give you back the same argument there. You're enabling. You may not be a child rapist or a child molester if you're in a Catholic church, but because you allow this church to keep going on as it is by remaining a member as this stuff happens, you are responsible. And the same for the grand old political party. They're responsible for this. This is a path they've been on for the last 40 to 50 years. I've watched it happen in my lifetime. Trump is not a surprise. He is not an anomaly. He's exactly what they've been building up to, step by step by step.
All right, Dana, let me squeeze in a couple of more calls before – I mean, Rama, let me squeeze in a couple more calls before our next guest. So I'm going to let you go, but thanks for the call. Let's go to Karen in Hardwick. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. I'm wondering if there's a bright side to this, maybe you could get McKibben on to tell us about the CO2 level.
That's a really good point, Karen. I think that's a good idea, too. I've been thinking about that, in fact, of Bill McKibben or someone else who follows the climate issues very closely, and maybe a couple of people actually to come on and talk to us about
it
this.
Seems because the Earth is breathing a big sigh of relief.
I heard one person describe the COVID-19 as a basically the Earth's immune system rising up to battle a fever. I don't know if I'd go that far, but that's just sort of an interesting thought there. But Karen, thank you for the call. I got to jump, but that's a really, really good point. I'm likely to do that. Let's put it that way. Let's go. Let's see. We have another caller, I believe, from Winooski, but I lost track of the name, unfortunately.
Okay,
Laura.
Laura, and I wanted to say something about your earlier guest in relationship to how the people who have been accustomed to attending church services mm-hmm. and how they're dealing with this, and you hadn't heard too much about it. I thought that's what you said. But anyways, I just want to report that in the little old town of Lowell, Vermont, which is up in the Northeast Kingdom, they have what's called Lowell Bible Church, non-denominational, mm-hmm. and about 70 people attend regularly for all of the services because they have a few activities in the week. But on most Sundays, it's 70. And so they were planning on having a Christmas Eve service and a Christmas Day service or a Palm Sunday or whatever. Whatever was needed during this time has been provided by the internet over Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go to Facebook and just type in search Lowell Bible Church. And it's amazing. And I think I heard from somebody that they generally had about 50 people tune in to Facebook at that time on Sundays.
Wow.
So there are people that are, I'm sure there is.
Laura, I think you make a really good point. Unfortunately, your phone connection is not very good, so I'm not going to keep you on long. But I appreciate your phone call because I think you raise a good point. A lot, and I thought I mentioned, I should have if I didn't, that has been the alternative method for churches that can't gather, where folks can't gather and go to church. They have been running online services, and I was making the remark. I think that I wondered if. You know, falling off of attendance in recent decades at a lot of churches might actually be reversed a little bit by people now deciding instead of actually getting out of the house and going out on Sunday morning or Friday or Saturday for other religious services, they decide they can do this from the comfort of their home and at their computer screen. Just another option for folks if that, in fact, continues into the future. So it could be a fascinating development in religion in our society. Laura, I got to let you go, but thank you so much for the call, and I really appreciate it. And I want to introduce my next guest, who is familiar to many, many Vermonters. She's been in the news in the last couple of years, not always in a super positive way, but has been battling through some very public issues here in Vermont that are of vital importance. So we're going to get to those, I think, a little bit later in this segment. But first, I wanted to welcome Kaya Morris to our air. She's a former state representative from Bennington. Good morning, Kaya.
Good morning, Dave.
And I want to check in with you first about your new job. You are working now with Rights and Democracy. And tell us a little bit about this. Maybe some of our listeners might not be that familiar with the group. So what is Rights and Democracy, and what are you going to be doing for them?
Absolutely. Well, good morning, everyone. So Rights and Democracy is an organization. It's a bi-state organization that is based out of Vermont, but also has chapters and organizing in New Hampshire as well. And I actually have a history with Rights and Democracy going back to their first beginning, when their founder, James Haslam, had approached me as a candidate, an incumbent up for re-election, to talk about building a grassroots people powered movement that would really help support getting candidates across all down the ballot who had a vested interest in moving forth with progressive policies and social justice issues, and were representational of many of our most marginalized as well. So a kind of different approach to thinking about what electoral politics should be about and ways to try to really help build that momentum and across the kind of local and statewide and national movements in that direction. So Rights and Democracy has been on the forefront of a number of really key battles that we've had here within the state of Vermont to try to raise the minimum wage, looking at healthcare for all, paid sick leave, so many different things that we are seeing and feeling in this moment of coronavirus and how it's really devastated our state. Many of those social safety nets that we're scrambling to find ways to patch holes in are ones that Rights and Democracy has been boldly asking and pressing for our electeds to get behind transforming so that we wouldn't be crushed in the ways that we are right now. So this is an exciting position. It's one that's been a few years in the making. It's one of just a handful in the entire country. And it's something that Rights and Democracy, we started actually talking about as an organization a few years ago when I was actually still in office, and really looking at what were the things that helped to support my election, my first time around, to really bolstering my reelection in the years following and helping to do what we call co-governance. So it's not just that you get in the office and you're there and you now hold that seat of power. It's an iterative, it's a constant conversation, it's a responsivity to the constituencies who placed you in those seats of power. And it's one that's going to require that in order for us to be really thoughtful and to make policies that are meaningful, that they are directly informed by the people most impacted by those policies. So if you are working on issues of racial justice, if you are working on issues of our climate crisis, if you are working on issues of poverty, that the considerations that are going in are deeply informed and driven by the needs of those groups that are that have the most to lose and will often be forgotten about as we look for, these are our little areas of our championship. This is where we won, the little spots where we won, but we left so many others behind and in some cases worse off because we did not bring their voice into that conversation from the outset. So this has been a long process, and they've worked with national groups like People's Action and the Center for Popular Democracy on really developing out a framework to do and achieve that very thing. So this position is based here in Vermont, and I will have counterpart in New Hampshire as well very shortly, that has that focus on building up from the grassroots up to also helping those same individuals, the ones that have been out there protesting on the climate strike before it was really big, the same individuals who have been on those letter writing campaigns and have been knocking on doors for their candidates and been doing all of this hard frontline work, to also showing them pathways to stepping into electoral policies and positions as well, to best represent ourselves, so that we stop being so heavily focused on just a kind of a white wealth narrative around who is deserving and who gets access to those seats.
Well, let me roll the clock back a little bit, if I could, to your first election campaign in Bennington. You said that you got some assistance and some guidance from Rights and Democracy back then. Is that right?
Not my first time. No. My first time was my first time. I'd say, you know, a lot of the strength that I got, a lot of the knowledge and the practical experience that I had that helped me with my campaign came from training through groups like Emerge Vermont. I really didn't get very much support from my political party. I had a scant crew of volunteers. I think I had two whole people ever knock on doors with me the entire time through my whole campaign. So it really was quite a bit of effort. Some of the people who assisted me were even from out of state trying to volunteer in ways that they could, because that infrastructure for supporting people wanting to even step into public office was just non-existent. And it still is the case in many, many communities that you really kind of have to make it happen on your own. It's this sort of like uber capitalism, pull your bootstraps and find your way into office, which is unnecessary and is a distinct barrier for people from the disability community, for people who
opportunity for individuals who are new Americans. There are so many barriers as it is to stepping into office that we want to try to identify those barriers and find ways to transform the environments that they're in so that folks can successfully step in and run and win, because those voices are crucial. So Rise to Democracy wasn't even formed my first time running for office.
Okay.
It wasn't until my second run that we kind of sat and had this conversation, and that's like, what is needed to not only get in, but then what's needed to govern effectively, right? So
right. So in terms of I want to focus, just kind of drill down a bit on Rights and Democracy's role then in your own kind of political career, to the extent that did they first become a presence in terms of this continuing governance you talk about kind of post-election, or did you first sort of connect up with them as you were running for re-election in your second campaign?
Yeah, I connected up with them when I was running for my second campaign. So it was
okay.
At that point in time, they were connecting up with various candidates to look at what even an endorsement process might look like.
How did that second campaign differ from your first or from other campaigns you know about in terms of what Rights and Democracy was able to bring to it?
Well, it was not only just that affirmation and support, but we seriously had street teams. I actually had individuals that went out, had call lists and helped to knock on doors on my behalf while we were doing phone calls and phone banking. They put out social media and their own literature and ways that many different advocacy organizations that do support candidates directly are able to do. And it was an enormous difference for me. Knowing that I was able to get in the first time without having that support, but having that support the second time around meant that I could do a deeper and a richer conversation with individuals as I'm going door to door and less pressed for time and able to get out and find out more about what people are actually needing, the questions that they were still holding as we're going into that next electoral process.
Kai, I hate to do this. I'm going to interrupt our conversation for just a moment to ask you about communications, because I have moments when your cell phone sounds loud and clear, and other moments when it sounds like you're talking from the bottom of a tin can. And I'm just trying to figure out, are you moving around, or can you get to the spot where it's nice and clear?
No, not at all. We're actually having quite a bit of challenges now with everyone on the internet and Wi-Fi and cell phone services. I've been struggling with quite a bit on that.
We
want to take a quick break. I try to use a different phone or call it from a different method and see if that might work better.
And I was asking you about the sort of some of the specifics of what Rights and Democracy did in your second campaign. We were getting a little bit into that. I also wanted to ask you, do you see this as these methods and so on as kind of translatable statewide? Do they work better in a tightly populated community like Bennington, or do they work as well on the dirt roads out in the rural districts? Or what's your sense there?
Yeah, these are techniques. And I don't even want to just drill it down to these are specific tactics that work, as it is an entire philosophy of how to approach an electoral cycle. I think that they are meant to work statewide, and they have worked with great success. You can see what's happened up in the Burlington City Council. A number of the new electeds that have gotten into office or re-election, they now have a progressive majority. That's really due to the strong work and advocacy and support of groups like Rights and Democracy getting behind candidates that they believe in. And we've seen that happen in other areas of the state and in New Hampshire as well. So it is really around empowering the people to take back their democracy and to be really true participants in it, instead of having to sort of passively be on the passive recipient end of everything that happens in those decision-making spaces. So...
I'll tell you what, let's talk, we're going to talk more about that process of taking back democracy and what some of the barriers are after we go to a brief, I mentioned we're going to be going to a brief break pretty soon. It's coming up upon us now. We're going to go to some CBS News at the bottom of the hour for a minute or two, and then a couple words from our sponsors, and be back in just a couple, folks. Kaya Morris, I hope you stay with us. We'll continue our conversation on the other side. We'll be back in a couple minutes, folks.
There's comfort in the familiar, but when life presents us with something exciting, we just have to embrace it. With so many of our neighbors producing such wonderful products, we just have to show and tell the world. Come in and see for yourself the old standbys alongside the new. Change is good. The one thing that never changes is our commitment to making your visit a great experience. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
We are back. I wanted to mention a programming note just after 11 o'clock when we go off the air, the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. Don't touch that dial because we're going to continue our coverage of the COVID-19 crisis with a news conference with Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials who are going to be giving the latest update on what is going on with the state's response to the COVID-19 situation. And that's become a fairly regular thing about 11 o'clock. Bill Sayers' Common Sense Radio show that normally airs from 11 to 12 will be moved to 1 to 2 p.m. today. So you can stay tuned after the midday news service for Bill Sayers and Common Sense Radio. But in that 11 to 12 hour, you'll be hearing from Governor Phil Scott here live on WDEV. So stay with us for that, folks. Back to our conversation now with Kaya Morris, former Democratic state representative from Bennington, talking about her new role at Rights and Democracy, an activist group in Vermont focused on getting progressive policies and politicians into office here in Vermont and New Hampshire, where the group operates in both states. And Kaya Morris, I wanted to ask you just one little personal question, which is you are a Bennington resident, have been for a number of years now, and my impression was that the Rights and Democracy tended to operate in the kind of Burlington Montpelier corridor up north here. Are you planning on moving, or have you moved, or what's going to happen there?
That's that question of curiosity everyone has. So yeah. We're taking everything one day at a time, and RAD is based out of Burlington, as a lot of things are up in the northern half of the state, but you all know that I fight pretty hard for the rest of the state. So I will be around and about no matter where I am calling home, without a doubt. So, yes, this coronavirus has definitely changed focus of quite a bit on, you know, where and when you need to pick up stakes and get moving.
So many people are, I mean, I'm broadcasting right now from my home in Montpelier. We've pretty gone to a skeleton crew at the WDEV studios in Waterbury. So it is a different world for sure. A lot of people working from home doing the telecommuting thing and so on. So maybe this will be the new normal even after the emergency has lifted. I don't know. We could save some miles on your car perhaps, but there you go. You know, look at the break. And hey, a lot of people. In fact, we just had a caller a little while ago remarking on the on one silver lining here is a lot less pollution out there. You know, you look at the pictures I've seen lately from like Los Angeles are just wow. It's a beautiful city. Who knew?
To keep that momentum, you know, and I'm glad actually you kind of brought that up because it's a really interesting and important point about all of this that we're really dealing with right now. I did need to place a plug if possible. Tonight, I am encouraging folks, if you'd like to join us, you can go to Facebook to Rights Democracy BC or Rights Democracy New Hampshire and find the link to join up on a Zoom call that'll happen tonight. It's a nationwide call. And we really have to start looking at where are we going to go from here. So while we may see these really positive things that are happening in our communities, the ways that our states and our nations are responding to this moment in time, these are things that are not meant to be temporary. These are policies and societal changes that can and should be built into our infrastructure to the future. So asking for our federal government to look at doing things like providing some sort of a baseline pay, these stimulus checks. We see that in other countries, they've done that in an iterative period over time, right? And that iterative period is exactly what a universal basic income is. That is the ability to make sure that people are not going to fall under in times that are difficult like this, so that you have a base to build from. So as we're seeing the climate crisis getting a little bit of a breather with some of this pollution, declinations, and how do we catalyze on this moment? How do we ensure that we're not going to go instantly backwards and maybe even double down on some of the gains that we've made towards going in a regressive fashion? So that's a lot of what's going to be on our minds as I think we're getting ready for this next period of time in this electoral cycle as well.
I'm wondering also what you think about the lessons being learned about and maybe in the healthcare system in this whole. This is obviously a healthcare event we're having here. What do you make of all that?
I think it's pretty devastating. I think it's pretty devastating, and not just for the individuals that are stricken with coronavirus, but with the healthcare workers themselves, who, while they have definitely signed up themselves to place themselves in a place of risk as part of their work and their life's work, that this is testing everyone to a way in ways that we really should not be seeing at this point in time in history. It's frightening to me to know how many people may fall through the cracks when you're hearing from folks in the disability community and they're talking about their true fears that if I go in for my own complex condition, will I be able to receive the care that I need if I go to the hospital, or will I be turned away? You know, because of the fact that there is a necessity to have more hands on decks to deal with coronavirus and the rates of infection, some areas of which are going to be pretty much devastated. I mean, Bennington County is, it's predicted up to 50% of Bennington County will contract coronavirus. Not everyone will be hospitalized, but that's the rate of infection that we're modeling out here. And that's the reality, is that our healthcare systems are going to be maxed out. We've already had furloughs within our healthcare systems from individuals not being able to have work because the revenues are just not there. And it's a system built on revenues instead of a system built on health. And that's why it's struggling right now so hard. The ways that we were doing it are clearly not sustainable. So we have to really, truly look at alternative methods.
Kaya Morris is my guest. She's a former state representative from Bennington and is what is the job title at Rights and Democracy?
Movement Politics Director.
Mm-hmm. Movement Politics Director is her new job at Rights and Democracy, two-state organization, New Hampshire and Vermont, which is promoting progressive policies and politics out there. And Kaya, I by the way, folks, if any listeners out there have any questions or comments they'd like Kaya Morris to hear, you're more than welcome to weigh in here. We're at 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury, the toll-free number 1-877-291-8255. And Kaya, who's a mythological figure that rises from the ashes? Is that a phoenix? I think. you are someone who is definitely bouncing back after some tough times. I don't know how much you want to rehash all of that, but talk to me a little bit about that sense of kind of, you know, being fully back in the game now in your own activism after that tough period of 2018 and so on.
Well, thank you. You know, it's interesting because I've always stayed busy. It's not like I wasn't still deeply engaged. I was just engaged in really different ways. So doing more work with Oxfam America and focusing on international aid and crises that are happening in different parts of the globe, focusing more really helping to support. And for over a year, I was the director for the Vermont Coalition for Ethnic and Social Equity in Schools. So still there, but again, still coming from the spirit that I'm carrying even into this position of how do we empower other people to step into these spaces of leadership and focus their voices. So it's less about my narrative and it's significantly more about the narratives and experiences of others, which are similar. So much of what I experienced in that moment, what I experienced when I first chose to step into office, what I saw happening even as a community leader before I even considered running for office, that's all informed into this exact moment right now, right? And so that's why this is such an important place, being able to say and work with colleagues like the National Council on State Legislatures, where we look up into places like Nova Scotia, where their Speaker of their Assembly is a paraplegic. And whereas here, I've tried in years past to recruit individuals from the disability community, and they're like, I'm not trying to be the guinea pig to see whether or not our state can give me the accessibility and accommodations that I need to properly govern, to not just, like, survive, like, make sure people have enough money to live on, right, while they're doing the citizens' legislature, which we know is a, like, you know, that's a massive barrier for many, many people to consider stepping into office and on any level. But then also thinking about how and will this system, it's going to fail, clearly, because we're not ready, but how quickly will they try to adjust to ensure that as an individual, your dignity and your humanity, your voice, which is crucial, will still be able to be heard and will be honored there, because you'll have the things that you need, you know, of substance to be able to remain there. So these are conversations that we're having, you know, as I'm talking with peers. I have a friend, for example, who's an expert in cybersecurity. And after things broke loose for me in 2018, really walked me through, like, take another look at what's going on with your internet and what's happening with your social media and your cell phone and so many different points of places where your privacy can be violated and where your history and your data are being mined, so that there's a dossier available for whomever wants to use it for whatever malfeasance. And that is something we know is a tactic that's going to happen to marginalized folks as they choose to step into the light in that way. And so so for me, I feel like it's part of this whole journey of saying, like, well, I did it, and I'm not saying this is a bootstraps conversation. I'm saying that there were things that were fundamentally flawed that have to change, and we're going to fight to change those because your voice is needed. There should be no questions about paid minimum, about paid family leave. Look at where we're at right now. We have paid sick leave, and look at where we're at right now. Had we had individuals that were making these decisions and were informing these policies who actually experienced poverty, who actually know what it's like to try to have to balance two and three jobs, who actually have a sense of what it means to actually have to use food stamps to feed their families, like, it would be a completely different conversation happening. And it's one that's necessary for us to be responsible in our governance, right? So those are the things that I'm bringing. All of this that's given me this opportunity to reflect, to help other people step up, because there's always somebody watching you on your journey who's like, I'm going through that too. You know, I'm experiencing this too. How can I do this and navigate this as well? So how can we help support each other?
Let me zero in on one aspect of, and I'm sure that Rights of Democracy, it's obvious you're interested in this topic, because this is a key part of participation and getting people to come out and work on issues and so on. And that is voting. We saw a real problem in Wisconsin last week, which sort of was not resolved in time. For we ended up with people standing in line to vote for hours, trying to maintain six feet of social distancing and so on. Mail-in ballots are one solution that have been suggested. The president last week came out quite opposed to mail-in ballots. He thinks that idea is an invitation to fraud. We look ahead to November, and I'm just wondering, what do you think about the shape of the election to come in terms of people's sheer ability to vote?
Yes, well, I do know that our Secretary of State, Jim Condos, has been very busy. There was quite a bit that was put into the national stimulus package that's coming here into Vermont, and Jim had already been working on some policies on the state level to move us towards a mail ballot system. And it's my understanding that that's the direction we're going for this primary. It's going to be very necessary, but there's going to be quite a few challenges. First of all, we need to keep our post offices open. Can I just put that out there, that the Postal Service were the one group that was most distinctly cut out of this entire process for our recovery stimulus funds, and that this is not going to be functional. So I just need to put that plug out there, that you all should be calling your folks and trying to find out more about ways to protect and support our frontline workers on the U.S. Postal Service. So our mail-in ballots.
Well, wait, you think the Postal Service should be ahead of, like, maybe the cruise ship industry for federal stimulus money and that kind of thing?
I mean, legitimately, like, if they're closed by the end of the summer, how do we do mail-in ballots if we don't even have a postal service and if that's not functioning?
That is a good question. Yeah.
You know, so these are real issues around access that are going to happen. So moving to a paper ballot is, I think it's a great first step. There's a lot that needs to be considered, and I want to make sure that the people that need to be in the room to bring up those considerations are there, thinking about what that means for plain language, thinking about what that means for literacy, thinking about what that means for translation, thinking about what that means for those who cannot use a paper ballot and will need to use other mechanisms and other means to be able to cast their votes. How do we ensure that there are not entire populations and sectors of our communities that are not able to participate in this process because of a misstep that we made? And it's, again, not coming in with a spirit of like, well, clearly y'all are going to forget about us. But it's like, do you have enough people in the room that someone can raise that what-if scenario that you need to talk through and be really considerate of to make sure that we have equal access to elections in this process? So, you know, what does that look and feel like for people? We, you know, looking at same-day voter registration and automatic voter registration, there's some huge reforms that have come through. And so I think it will be a fascinating conversation to have with Secretary Condo once things start to gel up so that we can start to prepare ourselves as well. As an organization, we got to talk to constituencies as well and be like, hey, do you know how you can vote? Like, let's make sure that everyone's feeling like they can participate in the process.
Clearly, you know, one of the big issues in our electoral politics these days is this question of turnout, really, of trying to get people who are eligible to vote to the polls. And Vermont seems to have a pretty good record on this and reputation on this. We still don't have super high turnout here. Why do you think that is?
I think that's still for a number of reasons. I mean, I think we are a state where a mail-in process might be more supportive and helpful. I mean, the election day itself, people don't really know about. There's still a lot of lack of knowledge around the ability to do early voting and what that looks and feels like, because, you know, you just don't know about your typical work day, whether or not it will allow for you to step out. There's many more people who still feel grossly uninformed about what they're actually voting on. So while mm-hmm. they may know names of individuals they might vote for, once they're getting to the rest of their ballot and they have to vote on different items from bonds to budgets, like, they can't, they feel lost in that process. And that's very disempowering for many individuals. I think that it's also, you know, I mean, many have talked for, it's not new to talk about having an election day being a state holiday, again, to try to help and encourage folks to be able to vote. I mean, I remember one year I almost didn't get to vote during the presidential election when President Obama was first running for office. And my work day ended, and I thought I had plenty of time to get back. And this is when I was still in Chicago, and I thought I had plenty of time to get downtown to my home and get to my voting place and be able to cast my vote. And because of glitches that had happened in the voter rolls, I barely made the cutoff before I wasn't even going to be able to cast my vote. I mean, and I thought I had hours of time to work with,
yeah,
in the line if need be, and do what was necessary, and my day was just eaten up. And so if you're a working individual who's got family or other obligations, things that happen at the end or the beginning of your day, it can be very, very challenging to be able to get out and to vote, to be able to do that. So some may not know about voter registration and how simple and easy it is for folks to register to vote in this state. And so they may not believe that they have the ability to do so. There's a lot of outreach that needs to be done for people to want to vote, to know how to vote, and to know what their rights are while voting.
We have a caller on the line. Refresh me.
It's David.
David from Burlington.
Yes, hi, Kia. Thank you so much for coming on today. It was really wonderful to hear you discuss your role in Vermont politics.
Thank you.
So I did have a question in regards to how I guess I'm somewhat new to rights and democracy, of what you stand for. So you're kind of giving me the introduction to all this. So I was kind of curious where the funding for rights and democracy comes from.
It's quite a bit of private donations and foundations. So there's no state funds or anything like that, no public funding for rights and democracy.
But does most
as
of
well as contributions at, from members and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Are most of the members from out of state, or
No. In order to be a member of Rights and Democracy, you must live within the state that a chapter is located within. And there are local chapters throughout the state as well. And so each chapter has its own kind of internal governance as well.
And so has its
own decision-making abilities. So, for example, when there's an endorsement process, each region will manage their own endorsements on certain levels for their candidates. And it's a, you know, so it's not a top-down. It's really meant to be a horizontal process for everybody involved.
I see.
And Rights and Democracy does get support from some of the labor organizations. Is that right, Kaya?
They're often in partnership with many different labor organizations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
We're deeply invested in trying to help support organized labor and maintaining organized labor's.
A lot of the issues cut across, you know, working people's wages and healthcare and et cetera. And I could see, you know, sort of natural points of solidarity there. So it does make sense, but
absolutely.
Kaya, I'm also I'm just wondering. We just have a couple of minutes to go yet here. If somebody is out there in Vermont thinking, you know, they'd like to go to Montpelier, run for the legislature, go to Montpelier and bring about change, your key piece of advice to them?
I would say the key piece of advice to them is to find an organization or an entity that might be able to help support you through that process. It can be very daunting and confusing, and everything is changing so quickly that you need some professional support to be able to navigate it all. So, but if you want to run, you should. It is your right to be able to do so and your ability to step into it. Do so. It's your democracy.
Don't be afraid, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know.
Yeah. No tank cuidado. Yeah.
Take that beard. Use it.
Yeah. Hey, Kaya Morris, I want to thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's great talking with you, and let's do it again soon. And good luck in your new role.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
All righty. Heading to the top of the hour here in the end of today's edition of the Dave Graham Show. Stay tuned now for a live news conference with Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials about the COVID-19 crisis. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre has been moved to 1 to 2 p.m. this afternoon. So stay with us right through our midday news service and on to the Bill Sayre Show. We'll be back tomorrow morning about 9:05. Tune in then, and we'll talk to you all. Have a good afternoon, folks. Stay healthy out there.